Welcome back to Inside Track for our autumnal equinox edition of Inside Track, brought to you by Wilkinson Wealth Management, Tucson Iron and Metal Retail, Essential Pest, and our newest supporter, Perfection Auto Works, where Mike makes autos great again. As advertised, we're going to take a trip in the Wayback Machine in hour two in order to talk about a very interesting and important story dating back to before the Second World War, which has been largely forgotten. Journalist Steve Drummond joins us for the entire hour, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. If you have a question or comment for Mr. Drummond, you can call in to the Inside Track live line at 790-2040. Our special guest this hour has been a journalist for many years handling a variety of beats, and he's also helped produce news on a national and local basis. Steve has just published his first book, as I mentioned before, The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. Welcome to Inside Track, Steve.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. So pleased you have accepted our offer to come on the show to talk about that new book. I'll say it once more again, The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. When Steve and I first connected, it was through my admiration for President Harry Truman, one of our great presidents and a man of enormous character and courage. Now, I read the book on Audible and really enjoyed it. You narrated the book, which is something unique, and I appreciated that you did that. Tell me why you decided to write and narrate The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II.
Sure, I'm happy to do it. I live in Washington, D.C. now, but I grew up in Detroit. My father was an auto worker, and some years ago, I was asked to write a magazine article on the, I think it was the 75th anniversary of World War II, and what was Detroit's contribution to the war. And in researching this story, I ran across some news stories about a famous bomber plant outside Detroit, right near where I grew up. It's called Willow Run.
Willow Run,
made B-24
yep.
bombers.
I know the area well.
Excellent. By the end of the war, this plant, unbelievably at the time, could make a four-engine bomber, the B-24 Liberator. That plant could roll out one every, say, 63 minutes, roughly one an hour. And that was a pretty amazing story, which I was familiar with. My grandfather had worked there briefly. But in researching the story, it became apparent to me that the plant early in its days wasn't working at all. There were no bombers coming out of there. The press had begun to call it jokingly, "Will it run?" And then I ran across some references to something to Harry Truman coming to Detroit to look into this. And I began reading about something called the Truman Committee, which led me down a internet rabbit hole of, you know, what is this thing? What was it? And in the course of it, I ran across some of the transcripts on the Truman Library's website of oral histories done by some members of the committee. And so basically, these are young college students or young committee staffers, many of them right out of college, who are in their first jobs, and they've been hired to investigate the war program, the defense program. Before Pearl Harbor, it was known as the defense program. This massive military buildup to try and get the United States ready for the Second World War, which had been raging in Europe for a year or so. And once again, the U.S. found itself understaffed, undermanned, under-equipped, under-armed. It's a recurring story throughout American history.
Yeah,
so anyway,
really
that's how I stumbled across the whole notion of the Truman Committee.
So I watched a recent video of a presentation he gave earlier this year at one of my favorite D.C. area bookstores, Politics and Prose.
Oh, I love that place.
Yeah. At the start of your presentation, you pointed out to the crowd there that the war actually started in September of 1939.
Right.
You've been involved in education during your career. Why do you think the history of the Truman Committee has been mainly lost, and how little is understood by Americans under the age of 50 about the Second World War? Because we're still living in that post-war period, although people don't like to think about it that way. They think in the present. But there really has been a lack of understanding about it. Your book really clears up a lot for people who might take the time to read it, don't you think?
Oh, it's funny you say that, yes. And it was something that several people who read early drafts of the book pointed out and encouraged me to do more, was that as the book went on, several people had said, listen, you know this World War II stuff up and down. And if you say, you know, June 1942, you kind of know what's going on then. But you need to remind your audience, where are we? Where are we in the story back then? Mm-hmm. So I tried to include the fact that, yeah, as the Truman Committee started, it was still more than a year before the United States, nearly a year before the United States would enter into the war. And so I kind of tried to point that out a little bit.
So talk about how the Truman Committee, as it became to be known, as was started in Harry's trip in his own car to Missouri to a Fort Leonard Wood, which was just basically in the initial development stage. That is a great, great story. That would never happen today.
Exactly. It's why I have to say, it's why, you know, you probably saw this too. Truman is so fun to write about. He's such a fascinating character. So yeah, let me set the stage a little bit. March 1940. So the war, as you mentioned earlier, had begun in September 1939 when the Germans invaded Poland. Britain and France soon got in. All this, the war had been raging since 1939. And 1940, Harry Truman was a first-term senator, a complete and utter nobody. As you mentioned, he was most known.
He was a senator from Pendergast.
Yeah, the senator from Pendergast, the famous boss of the Kansas City Machine, who was indeed a friend of Truman's and who had indeed, as the way politics worked at that time, handpicked Truman to be the senator. It wasn't fair that Truman was corrupt, though. He had served in combat in World War One. He had been a farmer. He had had a business that failed. He had served as a kind of the equivalent of a county commissioner called a county judge in Missouri. And he had done so honorably. But this link with Pendergast had tainted him. He went to the Senate in 1934 and for about 6 years did basically absolutely nothing. He sat and learned and watched and listened, but there were no bills. There was no power. He wasn't chairman of any committee. He was pretty much of a complete nobody. He barely won a squeaker of reelection in the fall of 1940, in November 1940. Franklin Roosevelt was one of the many people who expected that he would not win. And as Truman, you know, began a rest period after that campaign, he campaigned back to Washington in early 1941. And he was getting letters at this time from that army camp under construction at the time called Fort Leonard Wood. And people were writing to Senator Truman. They were saying, hey, something funny going on here. People are sitting around not working very hard. People are getting rich. There's lumber and materials just sitting out going to waste. What the heck's going on here? And you point out exactly, instead of sending a staffer out to investigate or sending a big investigation with groups of staffers and the media, Truman, in his very Truman way, he walks out of his apartment one morning in January 1941. He gets in his car, and he drives from Washington halfway across the country to Missouri.
And nearly doesn't make it.
Yeah, exactly. And there he sees what these people have been writing about. Guys are sitting around doing nothing. There are hundreds of men playing cards and goofing off. Materials are sitting out in the sun going to waste. Contractors are getting rich, soaking the government for, you know, added up millions of dollars. And Truman, who I said is a serious public servant, he's really upset about this. And as a combat veteran, he also knows, you know, this is no way to run a military, a war buildup. And he comes back to Washington basically hopping mad. He gets up on the Senate in February of 1941, and he makes a speech, and he says, hey, we should have a committee. We should look into this. We should be looking and making sure we're creating the military we need and that we're not wasting the taxpayers' money. And that's how the Truman Committee begins.
Hey, Steve, Ed Wilkinson here. We need to take our first commercial break now and hear from our great sponsors so we can pay the Bustos Mega Media Machine. No station flipping. We'll be right back in a few minutes with author Steve Drummond on his book, The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. Stay tuned.
Jamie Kipper and her father, Gary Kipper, from Tucson Iron and Metal. What are they going to see when they come through the gates?
So when they come on in, they'll see our building up front. People have free rein to then go out and look in the yard. So it's not a typical scrapyard with a ton of big machinery. We have a couple of forklifts around, but that's about it, just to help move material. So when you come in, it's all organized by material, whether it's square tubing, angle iron, roofing, and then there is a pile in the back, which is still organized and easy to get through, but that's stuff that comes over from the scrap. So we're unique in that we get stuff in from the scrap, which a lot of artists and people will like or reuse, whether it's a sink that someone needs for their house. We sell literally anything made of metal.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up.
With science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
The doctor will see you now.
Hey, how you doing today? Darn cigarettes. Would you like one? Cigarette?
No thanks. I don't smoke.
It's the only luxury I allow myself. And excuse me, I'm right in the middle of lunch.
Hey, you just got barbecue sauce all over my shirt.
My bad. Would you like a burger? We got plenty here.
No, I'm a vegan. You're having a beer?
Kind of eases the burn from these flaming hot Cheetos.
Doctor, your 12 gallons of ice cream are here.
Have them put them in the freezer.
That's a lot of ice cream.
Yeah, I just can't control myself, you know. I'm on a diet, though. Down to 260. Now, what are you in here for?
You know, I'm not really sure.
Do you oftentimes wonder if you're going to the wrong doctor? Same with mechanics. When you take your car to Perfection Auto Works, we not only understand auto and truck repairs, we are certified and know the industry since 1994. Complete auto repair, 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. Some people view market declines as a time to panic. Good news, that's wrong. Markets have never gone down and then failed to come back to create new highs, and this time it's not different. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call Eb Wilkinson at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
A little Missouri Waltz.
Yeah. Hey, welcome back to hour two of Inside Track. We're speaking with author and journalist Steve Drummond about his new book, The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. Steve, how unprepared for war and defense of the homeland was America in the late 30s and running up to the start of the war after Pearl Harbor?
That's a great question. And one statistic that I found really illustrates how badly prepared the United States was. In 1939, when war broke out, the United States Army ranked 17th in the world in size behind Romania. It's kind of a running theme in the United States from the Civil War on. A big war ends, there was kind of a constitutional opposition to a big standing army, and everything, you know, after the war ends, everything got, sort of dismantled. And the same thing happened in World War One. The United States had, you know, more than a million men serving in uniform, and as soon as the war was over, there was a great push to dismantle everything and take it all apart. When Truman started looking into this army camp business, he discovered that the plans created for the next war or another military mobilization had been misplaced or lost. And there was a feeling in the army that after World War One, there would never be another war again. So there wasn't
really
a point
to end all wars.
Yeah, exactly. The war to end all wars. And there was no real need to prepare for another one. So here it was, once again, the United States looking, facing a giant war and being absolutely unprepared. There were very few combat airplanes. The Navy was a wreck. There was a shortage of merchant ships, cargo ships, pretty much up and down the line, and certainly of soldiers and sailors and airmen.
Bruce told me that Senator Truman even traveled to Tucson as part of his committee in the summer of 1941, and our local historian David Layton even found the article about the visit to the Tucson Air Base. And I read Truman.
It was about one sentence in your book, and I just couldn't help but having David doing the research on this. Eb, go ahead.
Yeah, it says Truman backs little fellow, chairman of the powerful U.S. Senate committee, is air base visitor. Senator Harry S. Truman, Missouri Democrat, big bad wolf of defense program extravagance, and chairman of the investigating committee, holding the broadcast powers, or the broadest powers ever conferred upon such a body by the U.S. Senate, paid a short visit to Tucson yesterday with his party. Senator Truman lunched at the Tucson Air Base prior to flying on to the West Coast for a series of investigations. In general, the National Defense Program is functioning haphazardly, Senator Truman said. The OPM lacks direct heading, and added the senator, and there's a pitiful lack of coordinated policy in the matter of contracts and priorities. If it continues, small businesses by the thousands will go bankrupt, and big businesses will get bigger. Now, it continues on another two pages, but I can barely read what I read. You know, this is all from the archives. So after Truman discovered the waste and corruption, he went on to the White House. How difficult was it to get approved and funded, and how interested was FDR actually when he requested $25,000 and only got $15,000?
That's a great question. And those numbers are, even back then, that was peanuts. $25,000 to start an investigating committee, and eventually they gave him $15,000. That was barely enough to hire a lawyer and a couple secretaries. So to answer your question, Truman went to the White House to pitch this idea, and he got up on the Senate floor and said, hey, we should have a committee. Franklin Roosevelt and the Democratic Party, Truman's own party, was in control of the government. They were not happy about this idea one bit. An unknown senator poking their nose into the administration and the job that his own party and his own party president were doing, this was not popular at all. And so, having said that, it quickly became clear that if a Democrat didn't do this investigation, there were plenty of Republicans sitting around waiting to be critical of Roosevelt, waiting to conduct their own investigations. And so the Truman Committee became a bit of a steam valve, a barrier to say, hey, look, we're looking into this. So they tossed Truman a bone. They gave him $15,000 and said, sure, have your little investigation. The amazing story is Truman took that little tiny appropriation and turned it into one, as your news story just said, turned it into one of the most powerful investigating forces that Congress and the United States had ever seen. And that, to me, is the real amazing part of the story.
So talk about Hugh Fulton and some of the key staff people Truman had working for him.
Sure. One of the things that usually happened at the time, and frankly still happens today, is when you start these investigating committees, The key job is the chief counsel, the staff person who's actually going to run it. Usually it goes to somebody who just lost their political spot, or it's a political favor to some kind of party hack, or it goes to kind of a prominent lawyer who's very busy doing other stuff and making a lot of money in the private sector. Truman didn't want to do that. He went to the Attorney General of the United States and he said, I want your best prosecutor. Who's your toughest man? The Attorney General, Robert Jackson, gave it some thought and he said, I've got the guy for you. A 36-year-old lawyer in New York City who had just put the head of a utility company in jail. His name was Hugh Fulton. And this turned out to be one of the best hires Truman would ever make, a relationship that was the best thing that ever happened to both men, and it would play a key role in making the Truman Committee a success.
Tell our listeners, Steve, because it sounds different from how Senate committees are formed today. How did Truman select his fellow senators to serve with him, and how they related to one another during the course of this 4 or 5 years that they were all together?
That's a great question, too. And it was kind of a shifting balance. Truman had to negotiate with the vice president and the Roosevelt administration who the senators would be on the committee. But and eventually he chose five of what I refer to in the book as kind of a B list of senators. They were all decent guys, many of them in their first term. None of them were famous or political names or you know, sort of close to the power structure in the country at the time. Also, though, Truman said he had to have some Republicans on the committee. He really took the notion of bipartisanship seriously, and he chose two Republicans to serve on the committee. And that actually became a key part of the committee's success, was that it was bipartisan, that Truman took that seriously. He was willing to let others, including the Republicans, take the spotlight, and it was a key factor in the success. They worked really well together throughout the war. Many of them became friends afterwards. One of the Republicans, Harold Burton, Truman would later name to the Supreme Court, a Republican, a senator not of his own party.
That would have never happened. That had never happened today.
No, and so you see the distinction from today, where everything is so toxically partisan. Truman took the job of the committee very seriously, and he took the role of, you know, he treated the other senators, including those not from his party, as grown-ups, and he spent a lot of time trying to build consensus and get them all on the same page.
Yeah, that was a major point that you made throughout the course of the book, Steve, was about consensus building and that's how they operated. Talk about, because there are some...
Imagine if that happened today.
Oh, geez.
It's impossible.
So there were some huge companies who had massive contracts with the federal government doing lots of work when we finally decided we were going to build ships and airplanes and what have you. Talk about U.S. Steel and steel tolerances and a very brave man who came forward and the brilliant investigation techniques by the committee participants.
Sure. I'm so glad you asked about this because it's really the heart of the story. And just to back up a second, early on in the committee, Truman went on the radio one time and he said, you know, we're looking out for the little guy. We're looking out for small businessmen, as your newspaper article said. And he asked Americans to help him out. He on the radio and several times to newspaper reporters, he said, hey, if you see something going on down at the factory, if you see something wrong at the shipyard, something you have an idea to help win the war, let us know. Write to me. You know, Harry Truman, Senate office building, Washington, D.C. Darned if it didn't happen. At first, a trickle of these letters, but by the end of the war, more than 100 a day, people were writing to Truman with all kinds of ideas. Many of them were...
Thousands of letters.
And it's one of the great pleasures of writing this book is I've sat in the National Archives and I've had these letters in my hands, and some of them are, you know, have kind of wild ideas for how to win the war, or some magical weapon they think is going to create victory.
Steve, talk about the guy who suggested that every Army infantryman should have his own personal airplane and what he should do with this, with the contents in that airplane.
Yeah, that was Harry Truman's favorite one of these sort of, they called them crackpot letters. A guy had written in and said, hey, every soldier should have an airplane, and we should fill those airplanes up with dirt. In other words, U.S. soil. And the plan was that these airplanes would all take off at the same time, and they would fly over Tokyo or Berlin and drop this dirt and bury the enemy capital under a layer of soil. There were all kinds of just ridiculous ideas about that.
Right. So there were lots of crackpot letters, but talk about this brave man who came forward, who worked at one of the U.S. steel plants.
So outside Pittsburgh was a a giant factory of the Carnegie Illinois Steel Company, which was a division of U.S. Steel. A guy there named George Dye, George E. Dye was his name, and he was the inspector. He was the supervisor of the inspector. The plant took giant slabs of steel from other steel plants, and it heated them and hammered them and pounded them and made them to the specifications that could go in a warship or a tanker ship or some other use. And that's what this steel did. It was setting production records all around the country. But what George Dye saw was that this pressure to produce, this pressure to set records and make profits, they were cutting corners. If a certain slab of steel didn't pass inspection, didn't have the right strength or composition of carbon and steel and all the other chemicals that it was supposed to have, if it didn't pass inspection but maybe came close, they would fudge the numbers and they would just fake it and pass along bad steel as good steel. And the more George Dye saw this, and as the United States entered the war, he saw the pressure to do this increase, and it was very frustrating. He felt like, hey, this is a company trying to make profits here instead of trying to give the military or the merchant marines or the British Navy the best steel they could make. And he didn't know what to do. He began reading letters about Harry Truman and the Truman Committee in the newspaper. And in early 1942, he sat down at his desk on Brownsville Road outside Pennsylvania, and he wrote Truman a long letter, the first of what would become more than 30 letters over the next year and a half. And it said, hey, something's going on down here. The problem, as you know, was his letters were so technical and so full of jargon and numbers and equations. I've seen them. And you can barely understand them. And the young lawyers reading these letters at the Truman Committee thought, this guy's a nut. And we don't know what the heck's going on here. And basically, they dismissed him and they threw these letters in the crackpot file. And there they sat for more than a year.
But he didn't stop, did he?
No, he kept going. And eventually, and what happened was, in January 16th, 1943, in Portland, Oregon, a tanker ship, a brand new tanker ship, 500 feet long, it cost $3 million. It was never even been out to sea, but they were loading the ship, and it passed its sea trials. And they were loading it up, getting it ready for its first voyage. On a quiet winter night in 1943, the ship cracked in two. An explosion heard a mile away. The earth shook, expecting sabotage. The FBI and police and firemen raced to the scene. And there was the ship, broken completely in two. It looked like a giant had picked it up out of the water and snapped it in two. And the question was, what the heck happened here? Sabotage was quickly ruled out. There were a lot of theories about this, but the bottom line, no one really knew what had happened. 3 months later, the industrialist Henry Kaiser, who I think we've kind of forgotten about him today, don't you think?
Except for Kaiser Permanente health insurance.
Kaiser Permanente. Or the
old Kaiser cars.
Right.
But during the war, Henry Kaiser was one of the few people on the home front who helped win World War II. He road builder during the 30s. He's largely responsible for building Hoover Dam. And the war broke out. He turned his attention to building ships and shipyards. And all over the West Coast and the rest of the country, shipyards began appearing. And Henry Kaiser reinvented the way a merchant ship was built. Before the war, they would take months. By the end of the war, he'd have it down to about 30 days and one famous incident, 5 days. Well, this was one of his ships that had broken in two. 3 months later, in March 1943, the Truman and Committee had called Kaiser to testify. They wanted to ask him, hey, how are you setting these records? How are you building these ships so fast? How are you keeping the workers productive? And you know, he talked about his health care program that he had invented, that, you know, for the many of these workers, the first time they'd ever seen a doctor in their lives, and they could get treated quickly and get them back to work was the point. But at the end of this hearing, one of the senators, Owen Brewster of Maine, Truman was out that day, says to, by the way, one of these ships just broke in two out there in Portland. What the heck's going on there? Kaiser was reluctant to answer. He kind of dodged the question. He had taken a lot of beating in the press for this ship breaking up. And finally, the senators ask him again, and finally he admits it. He says, I have a report here that says the reason the ship broke in two was bad steel. We got bad steel from the Carnegie, Illinois Steel Company. Well, everybody kind of nodded and moved on from there, but all the young staffers in the Truman Committee were kind of smacking their foreheads because they knew in a room not far away, they had dozens of letters from an inspector at that very company saying, hey, we're shipping bad steel out of here every day. So several of Truman's staffers were on a plane to Pittsburgh the very next day. They met that night in the kitchen of this man, George Dye, who'd been writing them letters, and he told them what was going on. And he said, you need to look at these inspection records. You need to look at this book where they file all these records. They're faking these records. He had even drawn a map, a pencil on paper, a pencil map of the factory, and he had put little marks on there. Here's where the e-book is. Here's where the inspection offices are. So Truman and his the Truman Committee inspectors went to the plant the next day. They didn't say, hey, we want to investigate your bad steel. They basically said, boy, you guys have got a great factory here. You're setting all these production records. Do you mind if we could get a tour?
This was like an episode Columbo. Of Columbo, you
it
know?
It totally is. And it was one of many times the Truman Committee investigators went undercover in these factories. And in this case, they said who they were, but they didn't say their true purpose. They said, hey, can you give us a tour? President of the company, Lester Perry, arranged for a car. It took them over to the Urban Works. And there they started asking questions. And indeed, it was an amazing plant. They were cranking out steel. They were doing all this stuff. Hundreds of workers, hot slabs of giant slabs of steel rolling through this factory. And they were, of course, impressed. But as they went through, they started asking some questions. Hey, how do you keep track of all this steel? How do you make sure that it's, meets up to snuff, that it meets the specifications? And gradually they said, well, you must keep records of these inspections, right? And then finally they got down to, well, we'd like to see those inspections, to see the records. Well, here their welcome kind of came to an end. And the steel company started to realize what was going on. They clammed up. They initially told Truman investigators, oh, we don't have all those records. You can't look at them. Well, George Dye, the three lawyers there, knew exactly that the man was lying. They knew those inspection records were literally like 10 feet away. And they kept pressing. The Truman Committee investigators were not law enforcement officers. They couldn't arrest people. So they were kind of in a spot here. But they kept saying, well, we'd really like to see these records. One of them... phone, and named Bob Irvin, who is from a young lawyer right out of college, gets on the phone with Harry Truman. Well, Senator Truman, they're not showing us the records, I guess, he says very loudly. We'll have to issue subpoenas. We'll call everybody to Washington, and we'll have them testify before a public hearing with the reporters there. Well, now things start to change again. Well, it turned out they do have these records, but you wouldn't really understand them. It'll take a long time to look at them. Truman wrote Irvin, another lawyer named Rudolph Halley, they persisted. They said, we want to see these records. Finally, they get to see the records. This is my favorite scene in the book. It's almost, like you say, unbelievable. It's like something out of a TV show. They're looking at the record book, which George Dye had told them exactly what to look for. And they start interviewing these company officials. How come some of the entries are written in pencil? Oh, they said, well, when we don't have the exact records of the slab of steel, we call up the steel company that made the steel in the first place. And we ask them what the number is, and we write it down in pencil. Oh, okay. Well, that says Rudolph Halley. Some of them have an F written next to it, a capital F. Well, they're interviewing stammers and hems and haws for a bit, and finally he says,
Steve, I'm going to stop you right here. We need to take a break, the final break of the show today, and when we come back, you're going to tell us what the resolution of this investigation was. So we'll leave you there with that cliffhanger. We'll be right back with Steve Drummond. We're talking about the watchdog. I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all of the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices.
Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up with science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
Here. Over here.
For New York. This brings up the base for the Yankees. Runners on second and third, nobody out. The arm goes up in the motion. Here's the next pitch. There looks like a long punch into the bleachers for a home run. It is. The Babe hit it over the fence from the bleachers.
If you've been striking out at Quirky Lou, you're killing me, Smalls. Maybe it's time for an MVP mechanic who can hit automotive diagnostic problems out of the ballpark. Brakes, tires, electrical, air conditioning. We call them as we see them.
Strike! You're out of here! You blind!
Call Perfection Auto Works today, 323-8650, 1046 North Beverly, and PerfectionAutoWorks.com. And it's out of there!
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
America could use another Harry Truman today. Steve, let's finish the saga of
the cliffhanger.
The cliffhanger here, and then we're gonna talk about Happy Chandler and his swimming pool, and we're gonna talk about the tank lighter.
So as you know, that was a great time for the break. We had these investigators sitting there. They've confronted this steel company official in a lie. They've caught him in a lie. They know that. So they asked him, Why is the letter F written against some of these entries? The man responds, well, F means phone. Well, these are college graduates, lawyer. They know doesn't start with an F. And they've busted this guy. They take the secretary who's in charge of filling out these forms. They get her in a room and she tells him the truth. F means fake. So that starts the whole thing. Truman issues subpoenas. He calls the president of the steel company and the president of U.S. Steel to Washington. They hold hearings. And basically, this is one of the things that makes Truman a national figure and kind of a bit of a folk hero. Every newspaper in the country, fake steel investigation. The Navy gets fake steel. This was a number one news story around the country for several weeks. Truman's on the cover of Time magazine, and it's one of the key investigations that leads to him becoming vice president.
And saved probably hundreds or thousands of lives, as well as made sure that supplies definitely needed in Europe got there safely.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, hey, Steve, I actually grew up in Detroit and worked at Great Lakes Steel, so I know from what you talk. And I can tell you...
I have a really good friend who worked at that plant.
And I can tell you that I watched them test steel to make sure that it met all the specs. It's very fascinating to watch all that take place. So, hey, the War Department was thinking of World War II in terms of World War I warfare and equipment. Talk about their resistance on a piece of Navy equipment known as the tank lighter.
Yeah, this is another of the a major investigation the Truman Committee undertook. So tank lighter, they were called landing craft, or what they eventually were known as was Higgins boats. But this was a giant question in World War II. You know, and it would involve the invasion of Normandy, the D-Day invasion, and it would involve so many island invasions in the Pacific. How do you transport men and equipment across a body of water, you know, the ocean or the English Channel or wherever? How are you going to get them on shore? That was a huge question nobody had the answer to. They couldn't just pull into the port because the Germans or the Japanese can, you know, would just shoot them out of the water. So they had to come up to a beach 2 or 3 miles offshore. And how are they going to get these men and all this equipment onto the beach? The Navy had been investigating this, as had many other people throughout the war. And they had developed a design for landing craft. We've all seen the movies with Tom Hanks. He's going ashore. The ramp comes down and the men run off into the beach. That's what we're talking about here. Well, there was a New Orleans boat builder named Andrew Higgins who had invented a much better design than the Navy had developed. The Navy's, especially for these heavier ones that could take a tank ashore, that's where the word tank lighter comes from. The Navy had a terrible design. It was underpowered. It couldn't handle heavy seas. If they had adopted this design, thousands of men would have drowned. Dwight Eisenhower said these boats had helped contribute to the winning of the war. Well, this boat builder in New Orleans, Andrew Higgins, he could not get the Navy to listen to him. They wanted their own design. He was brash. He was a bit of a jerk sometimes, but he was a brilliant genius when it came to small boats. He went to Washington. He said to Harry Truman, hey, help me out here. Truman had a really good idea, and he went to the Navy, and he said, well, here's an easy way to fix this. Take one of this guy's boats and take one of your boats, put a tank on it, and see what happens in rough seas. This test happened down off Norfolk, Virginia. Higgins's boat, they put a 30-ton tank on these two boats, and they sailed them off. Higgins's boat delivered the tank to the beach, and then it came back to circle around the Navy design, which was in risk of sinking and foundering in the seas, and it circled around to wait until, you know, they could get the men off of it. And so clearly Higgins's design was the better. And finally, the Navy was forced to acknowledge this. They adopted Higgins's design. These Higgins boats went on to be one of the key factors in the winning of the war. As I said, Eisenhower praised them as a key factor in making the D-Day landings a success. And in large part, a lot of this had to do with Truman's intervention and Truman forcing the Navy to adopt a better design.
I've not been on a Higgins boat. But we actually assaulted the beaches of Camp Pendleton in Mike boats. I got to tell you, there's a reason Marines fight like hell. They do not want to get back on that boat and go back out into the water. It sucks.
The Marine Corps was clamoring. The Marine Corps was begging the Navy, saying, please get us these boats that we need. And the Navy, you know, is stubborn bureaucracy. They, you know, were protecting their own for whatever reason. They would not adopt this. And as I said, Higgins was very loud. He offended people. They would not adopt this design. And so Truman...
And yet it was superior.
It was a much better design. And there was one Marine general who said those other designs would, this is a quote from him, would have got us nowhere in combat but killed, the way this Marine general put it. So it's a significant contribution by the Truman Committee to the war effort. I've never been on a Higgins boat either, but there's a big museum down in New Orleans.
I've been there.
Was. I think they have one down
they
there,
do.
Don't they?
They do.
Yes,
it's pretty
they do.
Cool.
Yeah, I'd like to see it.
Hey, talk about Kentucky Senator Happy Chandler and the story of his swimming pool.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is a bit of a classic Washington boondoggle. And it's one of these things, too, where Truman did all this stuff. He loved to say later in life that the Truman Committee was kind of above politics and that he had, you know, risen. And many of the newspaper accounts praising Truman had said, you know, the Truman Committee was above politics. we all know there's no such thing as being above politics in Washington, D.C., or in the United States Senate. So in 1943, Truman gets stuck with a bad assignment. Senator Happy Chandler, a Democrat of Kentucky, has running for re-election, and he's gotten in a jam because his opponent has discovered that Chandler had just had a brand new swimming pool built by a friend who was also a contractor who was doing business with the government. A classic time scandal. Truman is stuck here. He doesn't quite know what to do. He doesn't want to badmouth one of his fellow senators, but he's kind of got landed this investigation. So he sends one of his investigators out there, a guy named Matthew Connolly, who sort of conducts an investigation. He establishes that, well, it wasn't the materials used in the swimming pool weren't the best quality, or they weren't really needed by the military. He, the opponent of Chandler, to file a deposition. The man says he can't do that. He's, you know, he has only had this evidence third hand. So Chandler basically comes back and writes a report that says, well, I didn't find any evidence of wrongdoing. And one of the other senators on the committee presents that to the Senate. And they have a vote clearing Chandler, and that's pretty much the end of it. So it's a little, it's one of the very few times where the Truman Committee was made by politics. I feel like Truman was in a tough spot here. He could have certainly been tougher on his colleague, but he wasn't. And that, as we know, is the way Washington works.
So the other way that, and it's sort of ironic, we're talking about this the day after that Senator Menendez gets gets arrested for having gold bars and, you know, $500,000 of cash stuffed in his suits.
It was $400,000, Bruce.
Okay.
Don't exaggerate.
Okay.
But he had $100,000 of gold bars.
So I want to end on something that is sort of funny, but really it says so much about how things have not changed in 80 years. Tell us about the doctrine of apparent frankness.
Yeah.
We just have a few minutes left.
They eventually it's funny how relevant the Truman Committee is to today. And many times they would see a general would come in and be subpoenaed to testify them before them. And they would stonewall. You know, they would ask them a tough question, and the person would say, I'm going to give you the full answer there. And they would talk on and on and on and on and on. Everything but answering the question, so that after a while, everybody sitting there had kind of forgotten what the question was in the first place, you know? Or he would turn to, you know, the general would turn to the colonel and say, well, Colonel so-and-so is here to answer that question. And the colonel would turn to the captain, and the captain would turn to somebody else. And it was just these ways of kind of dodging or stonewalling congressional investigations that, as you guys point out, still exists today. A lot of this hasn't changed. And so, again, it's still remarkable to me Truman was able to accomplish as much as he did, you know, in the way in this city in which we all know how it works. We still hear these stories of $100 toilets in the Pentagon budget or $80 wrenches or whatever. All this stuff still exists in the same way it did during World War II.
Senator, I'm really pleased you asked me that question. And I'll study it further and get back to you.
Exactly.
Reminds me of Charles Durning in The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. Ooh, I love to dance a little sidestep.
So did the Truman Committee achieve what it was meant to accomplish? And what have we learned from this? And have we learned our lesson?
Question that it did. These investigations had direct impact on the war effort. They saved the taxpayers certainly billions of dollars. Nobody, of course, can say how much, because you can't add up money that didn't get wasted.
Right.
Same thing with human lives. Those Higgins boats definitely kept men from drowning in seas. The committee investigated an airplane factory that was shipping bad engines to the Air Force, you know, to the Army Air Force. So there was a direct contribution in savings and money and lives. And of course, it made Truman a national figure and eventually vice president. And some lessons were learned. We've had many investigations since then that took some of the model of some of the things the Truman Committee learned about bipartisanship and, you know, conducting honest, open investigations without being, you know, grabbing headlines or whatever. And so, yes, we've learned some of those lessons, but yes, we all know how Washington works, and we still see a lot of these same things that have, you know, basically existed forever, which is people wanting to use the U.S. government to make money off of it.
Steve Drummond, thank you for chatting with us this afternoon. I love the book and urge our listeners to learn more about this part of our history. What's the best way to get your work?
Oh, my gosh, it's a great pleasure talking with you. You can buy it at your local bookstore. You can find it on Amazon. The audio book is there. And I'll be in Tucson at the Tucson Book Festival in March. I hope any of your Woo-hoo! Listeners or you guys will come by and say hello. And
we'll
We'll come on out and see you.
Best of luck to you, Eb.
Great.
Hey, thanks again to our great listeners and guests today, Tucson Mayor and Council candidates Janet Wittenbraker, Ross Kaplowitz, and author, journalist Steve Drummond. We have a great show for you next week. Look for our announcements on Facebook. Please check out our own Facebook and Twitter accounts for the latest news and our views on the news. All of the Inside Track episodes are available at Apple Podcast and the KVOI website. And Bruce, it is so good to see you back again.
Love being here. Love the heat. And looking forward to being together with you together all through the winter. So to complete the show today, this is Bruce Ash.
And Eb Wilkinson.
Wishing you all a lovely first weekend of fall. Eb and I hope you'll join us again in 166 hours. Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
A lot of the cities and the counties around have initiatives for artists. I think we're one of the premier artist suppliers for steel. First Saturday of every month, you can come down early and actually go through the scrap yard across the street. It's 7 acres of metal. You can walk through with our people and pick out what you want. It's always interesting to see what the artists have done. We've done actually a couple projects with the U of A engineering department and music department, where the engineering music students came down together. They had to pick something out of the scrap, and they had to build an instrument. And we have one of those in front of the plant. Some really cool things come out of the scrap.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard. 701 East 36th Street, open Monday through Saturday.
You know, Roger, you have the coolest car.
I know, but it's even cooler because you're in it next to me.
The lights of the city and this beautiful night, I just don't want it to end.
I have something for you that will make it last forever.
Oh, Roger, a ring? I've never seen anything so beautiful.
Will you marry me?
Yes, of course I'll marry you.
Ma'am, your car's ready.
Oh, I must have fallen asleep.
That Chevy coupe is a real treasure.
Mike, that song.
What's the matter?
Thanks so much for preserving not only the car, but so many memories.
At Perfection Auto Works, we're not just about repairing cars, but preserving wonderful memories. Start your new auto and truck repairs off right with our free 26-point inspection. Call today, 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. Some people view market declines as a time to panic. Good news, that's wrong. Markets have never gone down and then fail to come back to create new highs, and this time it's not different. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call Eb Wilkinson at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.